There is a story told in an old English drama about the sword of Belinus. It's worth repeating. The name of this sword was Trophimus. This ponderous blade, which had cleft the skull of many warriors in its day, was hidden away in the heart of a mighty oak tree, where it remained for ages. Not till the power of the Britons was put forth for a last desperate resistance to the Romans was it taken from its hiding place. And then it animated its possessors to the most heroic efforts to throw off the foreign yoke. Now that's the later story. But all their legends and stories connect. The period of the great and good Dunwallo and his famous sons is described by Spenser and Fairy Queen. Then up arose a man of matchless might and wondrous wit to manage high affairs, who stirred with pity of the stressed plight of this sad realm cut into sundry shares, by such as claimed themselves Brute's rightful heirs, gathered the princes of the people loose to take counsel of their common cares, who, with his wisdom won, him straight did choose their king, and swore him fealty to win or lose. Then made he sacred laws, which some men say were unto him revealed in vision, by which he freed the traveler's highway, the church's part, and plowman's portion, restraining stealth and strong extortion, the gracious Numa of Great Brittany, for till his days the chief dominion by strength was wielded without policy. Therefore he first wore crown of gold for dignity. Dunwallo died for what may live for aye, and left two sons of peerless prowess both, that sacked Rome too dearly did essay the recompense of their perjured oath, and ransacked Greece well tried when they were wroth, besides subjected France and Germany, which yet their praises speak, albeit they loath and inly tremble at the memory of Brennus and Belinus, kings of Brittany. Gergiant followed his father Belinus and was the second to wear the crown of gold. And if you go to a coronation, see it on TV as we will, that crown of gold traces back to Belinus. When the Danish king refused to pay the tribute which he had rendered in the preceding reign, Gergiant invaded and conquered Denmark. Many centuries later, when the land of Britain passed under the sway of the Danes, it was doubtless pleasing to the inhabitants to boast that in their legendary days the conditions were reversed. As the victorious Gergiant sailed home from the scene of his conquest, he met a fleet of Spanish ships, on board of which an unfortunate band of exiles had passed a year and a half on the open seas. The wanderers begged him to give them a home in his kingdom, and he assigned them an unoccupied tract in the land of Ireland. The Spanish exiles called themselves Barclenses, and their chief, Bartholomew. Now that connects to Ireland. I warn you. I want to get to how fast I can get over here. I want to get to King Arthur. Don't you want to get to King Arthur? I really want to get. Is anybody listening to me? Huh? This about brought to Billingsgate today. You know that? Just about brought to Billingsgate. That's where we left off, wasn't it? Brennus and Belinus. After Brute's descendants were killed, that rascal Pollux killed by his mother. He was sleeping with a room full of women, well-armed women. I'm not going to review. You haven't been listening to me? Well, that's tough. She buried an axe in his head. There ain't nothing meaner than a mean woman. That's why I made it my business to be so nice to them and to elevate them constantly. There ain't no woman ever going to bury an axe in my head. I want to see to that. They don't get in my room without a strip search, I'll tell you that for sure. I mean, I just made up my mind that that is a necessity for self-preservation. Has nothing to do with spirituality or morality. It's solely a matter of self-preservation. They even know that in Washington, don't they? Sheila. You women know what the price is. You that are hiding in the bushes trying to catch my men, I train my men to protect themselves. I believe prevention's better than cure. And I'm telling you, I just am not spiritual enough to want to be a dead saint. Thus died the last descendant of Brute. Ain't nothing worse than a mean woman unless it's one that has an axe. Well, then, a descendant of Brute out of Cornwall became king. He had two sons, Belinus and Brennius. And we were reading about their fights and their conquering of France and Italy and Rome. And Belinus spent his last years building up the kingdom at home, and he built at Troy-en-Avant, which is New London, New Troy, rather, where London is. The air conditioning working, it's hot in here. I mean, that encounter with those axe-wielding women heated the whole place up. Cool this place down. Gurgiant followed his father Belinus to the throne. I'm tracing the kings of England. Now, you've heard these various genealogy trees that link the thrones of Europe to the throne of Judah and to the throne of David. I'm taking this through English history to show you this has always been a part of their history. Gurgiant invaded and conquered Denmark. As the victorious Gurgiant sailed home from the scene of his conquest, he met a fleet of Spanish ships. The Wanderers begged him to give him a home in his kingdom. He let him go to Ireland. The Barclenses with their chief, Partholoim. Wethelin followed Gurgiant. Boy, you know that strange name. Would you like to be married to Gurgiant? Sounds like the guy is going to puke all the time. I'm glad we did short shrift of him. We're to Gwythelin now. But I can't see a man named Gwythelin. Gwythelin. Even more famous than he was his queen. Well, I can imagine if you're named Gwythelin.
How could you be a man with a name like that? That's worse than naming your boy Sue. His Queen Marcia, whom Spencer calls a woman worthy of immortal praise. This royal lady was possessed of rare wisdom and learning. And you know, they used to play that drama by Thackeray about that old broad burying that axe in her kid's head for Queen Elizabeth. What a motivator that must have been for Elizabeth. This royal lady was possessed of rare wisdom and learning and a strong sense of justice. She fairly earned a place among the notable lawgivers of the world. The Marcian laws, a code supposed to have been named in her honor, existed with little or no change for a vast period of time. 1,000 years ago, the Marcian laws were translated into Anglo-Saxon by Alfred the Great. Guithelin died, leaving a son, Sicilius. Boy, I mean, it goes from bad to worse. Let's have the girls come and sing. I can't take these names. I got to get up to old King Cole. Now, he was a merry old soul. Merry old soul was he. Called for his pipe, and he called for his bowl, and he called for his fiddler's three. Well, he wasn't named Sicilius. What a terrible name. Candidate for a deacon board. You got a new song. Sing it. Now, you've all heard the story, haven't you, about the fellow that dreamed he died and went to heaven, and they were showing him around heaven, and he was seeing all the glorious things that the Lord had prepared for his saints. He saw this big old eyesore in the middle of the square downtown, big old tent, black tent. And his curiosity just getting him down, because they'd walked all around heaven. This tent just keeps following him. So they'd stop to rest for a minute, and he walked over and started to lift the tent flap. And the angel was guiding him and said, "Don't do that! He says, "What?" "Don't do that!" Now, I'm pausing because I could put a lot of names in this place. But he says, "That's them blank blanks." Now, you can name whichever church you want to put there. They think nobody got to heaven but them. And if you open that flap and they find out the rest of us are up here, it's going to ruin their heaven. Well, this song shows that even people like that can get a little bit of a hint of insight from inside the tent. Because it says, here's some of these poor saints in that tent. We thought heaven was going to be a little bigger. We kind of had a heart set on strolling streets of gold. Although we feel no pain, and that's part of heaven, and there's no chance of rain, staring at these tent flaps is quickly getting old. We thought heaven was going to be a little brighter. At least it shows we were right when picking heaven's crowd, because the saints who live like we are the only folks we see. But what really makes us moan outside these canvas walls sounds like a party's going on. I like it. This is the boring part of English history as we approach the what has been called the written history of England. You know, if you pick up any history of England, any college textbook, it's usually going to start with Julius Caesar. Why? Well, because the people in the British Isles had no written language until Julius Caesar came and did his memoirs of the war, in which they were called barbarians. Julius Caesar was so dumb by comparison to a Druid priest, it's like Einstein being criticized by the local head of the Ku Klux Klan. That's about a good analogy. They went to school 20 years before they were ordained to their priesthood. They carried with them the knowledge they had learned in Egypt. It had been passed on to Greece and then to England. It's only taken recent years to understand that the runes and ogham represented a very sophisticated alphabet and writing. But do you realize how many history textbooks would have to be rewritten? Do you realize the vested interest that publishing houses have and the books that are on the shelves and the interconnections between professors who already committed themselves? It's just as hard for a history professor to stand up in front of his class next year and say, "I've been taught wrong," as it is for a preacher to say it. The Germans dominated historical research and historiography, and they centered everything. After Darwinism conquered the world, they centered everything in the Greco-Roman Empire. And once you took Darwinism and applied it to social development, you were boxed in with a hypothesis that allowed no alternative. Man had to start out the equivalent of the savage embryo and develop upward. So you looked at modern society as they knew it in the Western world, and you concluded that the apex of history as they knew it was Greek and Rome. The pyramid didn't really gain prominence until Napoleon's savants, in his war in Egypt, took back the knowledge to Europe, and then primarily the Scottish astronomers and engineers that led the way in studying the pyramid brought it to prominence. Archaeology was not born until Winckelmann's work in the digs that the queen of the two Sicilies had done at Pompeii. It didn't really reach its stride until Schliemann proved all the theories wrong by digging at Troy using Homer as accurate Bible to find the location. Lollard had to dig at Nineveh. Boucher had to take that Rosetta Stone dug up by one of Napoleon's soldiers. Champollion had to discover that hieroglyphics was not picture writing like cave dwellers, but a highly sophisticated alphabet. And the Rosetta Stone enabled the cracking of the hieroglyphics. Lollard's digs at Nineveh, followed up by the work of George Smith and the discovery of the Gilgamesh epic that turned the world on to the value of archaeology, Rawlinson, hanging by scaffold on the Behistun Rock, that like the Rosetta Stone, offered the clue of translating heretofore closed languages. The digs by Evans at Crete that came up with Linear A and Linear B. Cuneiform writings with the early Phoenicians. And I'm going to just tell you something flat out. One of the first times I've done it since I started teaching. Nobody tells you who the Phoenicians are. They show up as the sea peoples. Conquering in Egypt and around the Mediterranean basin, settling on the coast of Palestine, forever being a thorn in the flesh of the Israelites. That mighty Minoan civilization on the Isle of Crete that was destroyed in a vast earthquake that has amazed modern archaeologists because of its vastness. It rivals the pyramid in some respects, the palace at Knossos. Some have called the earthquake off the Isle of Terra. The burial of Atlantis. I think in error, Atlantis was out past the Straits of Gibraltar. But some mighty civilization, still preserved on Crete, the Minoan civilization, able to be outdistanced by the Mycenaean civilization because an earthquake wiped it out. It had no fortifications. That island fortress was protected by its navy. The greatest shipbuilder the world ever seen at that time was Noah. The Cretan or Cretian civilization was none other than Noah. He settled on Crete. And the Phoenicians are the Cretians after that great earthquake, looking for a place to land. And you will find the secret to the Phoenicians when you trace it back to Noah, and you have another branch of the Semitic line through the Phoenicians. And Shem and Noah were the big guns of the Mediterranean. It's Shem who built Jerusalem and is called Melchizedek. That's another story. If you have swallowed hook, line, and sinker that man was a savage, evolving under the laws of natural selection, and the survival of the fittest brings the highest form to Rome and Greece, and the modern world is but a perpetuation of the peaks of Rome and Greece, then you make no room for the possibility that the Semites and the promise of God through Shem is being displaced by Greeks and Romans. It takes the turn of the century, the Linear A and Linear B that open up cuneiform concepts which enable you to start understanding the Phoenician script and the Ogham script and those ancient Celtic writings, the digs at Halstead and Latin in the 1800s that reveal a culture among the Celts that hardly qualify them for Julius Caesar's epitaph. And then the work of Cyrus Gordon and his successors to prove that even Greece and Rome drew, Greece in particular, and the Hebrews from the common source of knowledge in a seedbed in Egypt, to realize history is exactly what someone said it is, his story, the historian that's writing. Now, all I'm doing now to give the gestalt and the feel of what I'm doing is showing that the information has always been there. I had somebody call the other night and say, we studied Spencer's Fairy Queen in school as poetry, but never as history. We never ever saw the connections of history. You go to Shakespeare's plays and think he had a wild imagination. This has always been a part of English literature. It took the 1800s to provide the keys that could synthesize it all, to find the names of the lost tribes, the foreign names under which they sailed during the period of their hiding. And God always had a destiny in these Isles of the West. Now, by the way, if an Atlantis existed, these British Isles were the bridge between Atlantis and Europe and Egypt and the Middle East. Instead of the farthermost perimeter of the world, centered in the Mesopotamian Valley, if Atlantis existed, and the world was anything like it is now in terms of landmass, then the British Isles were the crossroads. But that's another subject. What I'm trying to show now in this boring period of history is simply to make the point. The knowledge has always been there. The literature, the poetry, the art, the dramas. Nobody wove the thread of connection. And at the risk of being boring, I'm going to do it, though these names take it out of boringness. Guithelin died, leaving a son, Sisilius, with 7 years old. It's a crime to make a seven-year-old boy have a name like that. Sisilius. The great Queen Marcia was made regent, ruled during the minority of the prince, and again Britain learned to respect the sway of a woman. You remember little King Josiah? You remember the stories in Joshua, Judges, and 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles? I'm making the point the fruit does not drop very far from the tree. This could have been a chapter in Judges, a chapter in the Chronicles. Sisilius was succeeded by his two sons, Camarus and Danius. Then came Morvidus, a depraved son of the latter king. Morvidus, though able and handsome in person, was a man of furious temper and bloody deeds. He tortured his prisoners of war, flaying them, burning them alive. He had five sons who succeeded him in turn. Of these five sons, Artegal and Elidur are familiar in our literature as the subjects of a beautiful poem by Wordsworth. Now, how many have heard of Wordsworth? How many knew, in studying English literature, he wrote a poem immortalizing these two sons in the line of brute through Cornwall, one of his sons? No hands. Nobody, one does. Our Presbyterian, one does the connections. Gorbonian was the first of the sons of Morvidus to reign. Artegal surrounded himself next with base companions and despised the nobles of his court, plundered the wealthy, and piled up a vast treasure. At last, his people rose up in fury, drove him from the kingdom, placed on the throne the pious Elidur. For 5 years, the dethroned king wandered, an exile in foreign lands. Like a prodigal son, when he came to his senses, realizing he had been wrong, he resolved to return to his native land in secret and hide in the forests, content to drink from Britain's springs, live in the woods. King Eldor, when hunting in the forest of Calatter, came suddenly upon the outlaw and recognized him. The meeting seems more strange than the tales of fiction. There were no reproaches on either side. Eldor recognized his brother at once, fell upon his neck in joy at the reunion. Secretly, he took him to the city of Aklud, and there, feigning illness, he summoned his nobles from all the kingdom to attend him. Each noble, on entering his abode, was compelled on pain of death to recognize Artegal as king. This act, so singularly contrasted with the ambitious rivalries of princes in all ages, won for Elidur the sobriquet of Pious, by which he has been called ever since. Artegal reigned 10 years. He was the outlaw, setting an example by virtue and benevolence. The story of these brothers does not deserve to be lost, and it wasn't. Wordsworth chose it for the inspiring poem to which reference has already been made. Of the restored king, he says, heart smitten by the heroic deed, the reinstated Artegall became earth's noblest penitent, from bondage freed. Of vice thenceforth unable to subvert or shake his high desert, long did he reign, and when he died, the tear of universal grief bedewed his honored bier. Thus was a brother by a brother saved. Again, the point I make, it's all been there in English literature. Nobody connected it to Zara and Judah. His two remaining brothers conspired against him, overthrew him, imprisoned him in the Tower of Troy and Avant, and divided their kingdom between themselves. After 7 years, Viginius died. Peredurii reigned alone. Peredur then came to sudden death, and the hearts of the people turned again to good King Elidore, who came forth from his prison, bent and gray, finished the work of his life upon the throne he had twice relinquished. When he passed away, the succession came to the son of Garbonian. Singularly, of all the five brothers, the generation that Eldor reigned, it is related that their 32 sons and grandsons succeeded, but most of them we have names only, a very boring genealogy record. John Milton, the great poet of the Reformation who wrote Paradise Lost, wrote also A History of England and included in it the story of the legendary kings of Britain. It's always been there. Geoffrey of Monmouth, John Milton. When he came to these reigns, the boring period, though he included it, he showed impatience. A score of the very shadowy sovereigns he speaks of as 20 kings in a row who either did nothing or lived in ages that wrote nothing. A foul intermission in the author of this, whether history or fable, himself weary, it seems, of his own tedious tale, just dismissed him with 20 kings in a row. One of the 20 was Blegabred, who excelled all the musicians that had been before him. We don't have a note or a word of his songs. The aged Heli and others remembered as having reigned for 40 years and reared two sons of great renown who succeeded him. These sons were Lud and Coswallon. The former, it's claimed, gave his name to the city, Ludden, and changed it from New Troy. The reign of Lud is singularly lacking. Quote, happy is the nation whose history is dull, is an adage often repeated. Years of peace don't excite you, like axes in the head of sons who sleep with rooms full of women. A guy that has more than one woman in his room when he's sleeping is asking for it. Lud rebuilt on a large scale the wall which surrounded New Troy. Various other building things. Let me skip along. He built Lud's Gate, now known as Ludgate, a noted quarter in London. William Warner has quaint stanzas related to Lud, or Lud. A many kings whose good or bad no writer hath displayed did follow Lud and Haley for their stately buildings made. Rest chiefly famous nor forget King Blegabred I shall, whom Rutans did their glee god for his skill in music call. And on it goes. Oh, if you get the point, I don't want to insult you or talk down to you. We're in a little bit of a drag period of the history. But it's all there. Various poets, dramatists, writers have it there. With the reign of Cassivellaunus, the written history of the Britons began. For in the time of this king, the mighty Roman Julius Caesar led into Britain an army of invasion. It was supposed the Britons didn't have a written language because the dumb Latins couldn't read it. They outsmarted those Romans right and left. They thought the Druids were a bunch of savages, when, as I've said, they were so ahead of the Romans that they couldn't even figure out they knew how to read and write. With Julius Caesar's writings and commentaries, we have what is called the written history. And yet, look how far we've come. With Geoffrey of Monmouth's stories of Brute and his trip from Troy to found New Troy. Legend tells us that when Caesar first invaded the country, a brother of the king named Ninius was struck at by Caesar himself, but caught the saber stroke upon his shield, and that the sword sank so deeply into the shield that the owner couldn't pull it out again. And thus the weapon became a British prize. Ninius, however, soon died from another blow which Caesar gave him. He was buried with many honors near the north gate of the capital, and Caesar's sword was placed in his tomb. Caesar's second invasion came. Cassa Villanus drove into the riverbed huge piles of iron and lead to prevent the passage of Roman boats up the Thames. British chiefs began to quarrel about this time. And after the first encounter in this second war with Caesar, the Britons deemed themselves the victors because they had effectively blocked the River Thames, held a grand celebration at Trinovantum, or New Troy, which city was under the immediate command of Androgeus, the king's nephew. Great nobles were present, and they had general feasting and rejoicing, and among those who took part in the games were Heraclius, another nephew of the king, and Evelinus, a nephew of Androgeus. The two young men were opponents in a wrestling match and afterwards fell into a dispute as to who was the victor. The contention became very fierce, and the quick-tempered Evelinus, suddenly grasping his heavy sword in a transport of rage, struck off the head of Heraclius at a blow. So sudden was the act, sounds just like the Israelites fighting. So sudden was the act and so unexpected that those who saw it were bewildered. Androgeus, being in command of the city, held that it was his right to judge the murderer. The king maintained that the judgment lay with himself as the sovereign. Androgeus, being deeply offended and claiming that the act of Evelinus had been accidental or else in self-defense, wrote to Caesar offering to make a common cause with him. He then closed the city against the king. Cassivellaunus happened to learn what Androgeus was doing and at once began a siege of New Troy. But when he discovered that Caesar was moving forward, he went to meet him, and Androgeus followed. The king was between the two foes, the rebel Androgeus and Caesar on the other side. He was thus easily defeated. Caesar's version of the story is a little different, but it still involves the surrender, or the defeat, rather, of Cassivellaunus. In all probability, the varying accounts both refer to two sides of the same event. Even the historians are not always to be relied upon, as the following story of this campaign is told by Polyaenus, a Roman writer of history. A great river in Britain was obstructed by the horses and chariots of Cassivellaunus. And on it goes. Again, I don't want to bore you with the Roman story. Three accounts of the same battle. Androgeus is said to have left the country in company with Caesar. Cassivellaunus lived 7 years longer and died, was buried at York. Tenoantius, the brother of Androgeus, succeeded him. This is why people, it gets kind of boring. People don't like to do this research. But it's all in British records. The British story of Caesar's invasion is told in the following stanzas from Spenser's Faery Queen, which follow a mention of Androgeus and Tenuantius. And I don't want to read it again, because he gets lengthy. Now we're up to Caesar's defeat of Cassivellaunus. Well, let's keep going. While Tenuantius reigned, the brother of Androgeus succeeding Cassivellaunus, while Tenuantius reigned, his son, Cymbeline, or Cymbelinus, spent much of his time in Rome as a hostage, became much attached to the Roman emperor Augustus Caesar. On the death of his father, Cymbeline reigned in Britain. Only the briefest mention of his reign is found in the legendary history. Yet for several reasons, he's prominent among the old British sovereigns who are remembered. It was in the time of Cymbeline that Jesus Christ was born. You can always fix the reign of Cymbeline for that reason. His name, too, is a subject of interesting speculation. We're still in the lineage of Brute by Cornwall, one of his sons. From the historic times in Britain, the Campbells of Scotland have been a noted family. They are the descendants of Cymbeline. Shakespeare's powerful drama of Cymbeline has been the chief agency in perpetuating and popularizing the name of this ancient king. Have any ever seen that drama by Shakespeare? Did you know that it was a descendant of Brute? Again, I want a Gestalt today. And the Gestalt, as I've been reading this British history, sometimes you say, teach, teach, I leave you dangling. When you start filling in the finish works like building a house, the point I want to make from this little record is that the knowledge has always been there. Why haven't we been told? The king's two sons, Arviragus and Guiderius, were stolen in their infancy. His daughter Imogene was brought up by a stepmother who was a scheming, ambitious woman and who designed to bring about a marriage between Clote and her own son by a former marriage and the princess. Imogene, however, was true to her own heart's choice and privately married an orphan who had been brought up in the court and had been her playfellow from infancy. The wrath of the king was kindled when he learned of his daughter's marriage to a subject. And though posthumous, the orphan was a worthy gentleman and the best scholar in the kingdom, he was immediately banished. When he parted from his young bride, she gave him a diamond ring, which he promised ever to keep, and he clasped upon her arm as a parting gift a beautiful bracelet which she wore at all times, day and night, in loving remembrance. Posthumus went to Rome, where unfortunately he became acquainted with a villainous young man named Iachimo. Posthumus was wont to boast of the beauty and fidelity of his bride and became the subject of some bantering in reference to her. Provoked at this, he was led to wager upon her honor. And Iachimo resolved to put this to the test. Posthumus was so certain of the faithfulness of Imogene that he didn't see any harm in allowing Iachimo to try to disprove it. Iachimo visited Britain, where Imogene received him kindly as her husband's friend. The princess, however, resented any attempts on his part to make love to her. Then Iachimo, determined to win his wager, was base enough to slander her. He succeeded in entering her chamber unobserved and hid himself in her trunk until she had retired. Then in the night he stealthily arose and unclasped the beautiful bracelet from her arm that had been given to her by Posthumus. He made note of everything in the room, including the pictures on the walls. Returning to Rome, he claimed his forfeit, showing the bracelet which he declared Imogene had given to him in her room, and describing the apartment in detail. Now, that would sort of shake you up. Posthumus, crazed at the tidings, cursed his wife and gave her ring to his false friend. He even wrote to a friend in Britain named Pisanio and desired him to meet Imogene at a certain place and assassinate her, kill the broad. Pisanio, being sure that... Now it's starting to get a little more interesting, isn't it? Why is it that all this stuff's more interesting than those dull 40-year reigns? Sinners are just more interesting. I mean, God must have it in mind when he covered us all up with grace so he could have a little life up in heaven. I mean, it'd be awful to live all through eternity with Sicilius. Who's that other idiot? And that do-nothing. Sicilius. See, I forgot their names already. Sicilius. Who? I can tell he made a great impact on you. Who? Gwendolyn? No, couldn't be Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn. I mean, I turned off so much on him that I think the pages stuck together where he was at. I mean, I can't... Gwendolyn. Not Gwendolyn. Gwendolyn. My Lord. Now it's starting to get exciting. Pisanio, feeling sure that Posthumus would repent of his rash vengeance, met the princess with kindness. He advised her for protection to assume the garb of a young man. See, there's run around drag even in those days. I mean, you're going to expect anything out of these descendants of Judah. I mean, they were good at disguises and concealing their identity. I mean, you never knew when you went in the tent who you were there with. He advised her for protection to assume the garb of a young man. Go to Rome, meet her husband. Acting on this advice, Imogene dressed herself as a youth and assumed the name of Fidel. Now, as they say in the modern world, if he had changed his sexual choice, Fidel would have been in for a shock, and so would he. But, thank God. Then she started on her lonely and dangerous journey to the coast. I have too fertile an imagination. In passing through a forest, she came to a cave. Having lost her way and being weary and faint from travel, she entered the cavern, which she found unoccupied, though it contained some food and evidently was used as a dwelling. Two young men soon came to the cave and welcomed the tired stranger. Afterward, they went away for a hunt. Sure good that they did. I mean, you know, considering all this deceit that's going on, you needed occasional separation for a bathroom break. You know, I study these things, you know, see whether they're realistic. Ain't no way they could have pulled this off if those guys hadn't gone hunting. I know that. Afterward, they went away for a hunt. I'm trying my best with this boring story, folks. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Afterward, they went away for a hunt. Imogene, in her weariness, drank of a potion which Pisanio had given her to produce a restful sleep. Why do you find that funny, Peter? Are you putting your wife to sleep or something? See, look. Now, Shakespeare wrote about this drama, and then here is Liesenmeyer's painting. The theft of Imogene's bracelet. Now, thousands of people have walked around in art galleries and didn't even know the story behind that painting. The young men returning found her in a deathly stupor. Supposing that their guest was dead, they removed the body from the cave and in the depths of the forest covered it with leaves. And there's Imogene and Pisanio. Lots of art on this. Covered with leaves and flowers and sang a funeral chant. The one which they had sung as a funeral honor to their mother. Now, just put some flesh and blood on this one. How would you like to wake up under a bunch of leaves and flowers with somebody singing a funeral dirge over you? Awakening from her stupor, the bewildered girl found herself alone. I guess she didn't wake up till they stopped singing. Thank God for that. In the dark woods, and again sought the coast. Meanwhile, war had broken out between the Romans and the Britons, and a Roman army had landed in Britain. Posthumus was with the army, but intended to desert and aid his countrymen. He cared nothing for life, courted death. He had lost Imogene, nothing to live for. You lose a good woman, ain't nothing to live for. I mean, I'm living ever conscious of the falling axe.
Imogene met the army ere she could reach the coast, and as she appeared to be a bright young man, she was accepted by the Roman general as his page. Now she's... Well, let's go on. I'm boring you. Huh?
I think I am. That's a very boring story today. I don't think I'm ever going to get to Constantine.
The two young men of the cave, whose names were Guiderius and Arviragus, went with Valerius, their supposed father, to fight for the king. These three, with Posthumus, fought so bravely as to save the day for the Britons in the battle which followed. Imogene and her master were taken prisoners and were brought before the king. Posthumus surrendered himself to one of the king's officers and was brought into the royal presence to receive judgment for disregarding his sentence of banishment in returning to Britain. The meeting of all these before the judgment seat of the king forms a very interesting scene in Shakespeare's drama. Posthumus did not know Imogene in her male attire, but Posthumus did not know Imogene in her male attire, but I love to stop on these butts. Posthumus did not know Imogene in her male attire, but the what? But the what? But the what? I'll teach you to look bored in my presence. I'll stop with the but the what. Teach you to look bored in my presence.